Welcome to That One Record. I'm Kyle Cresce, and this is Episode 7. Today we're going to be sitting down with three members of the Sidekicks to discuss their 2012 album, Awkward Breeds. This record for me is an all-timer. It's definitely in my top 10. I'd even argue there might be two Sidekicks records in my top 10. I cannot say enough good things about this band. This record specifically was a real jumping off point for me. I had heard the name. This was around the time that whole world of Tiger's Jaw and that Run for Cover records was really popular, and I saw Tiger's Jaw had put out a split with this band, the Sidekicks. I had seen the Grey 7-inch after that, and then when I heard kind of buzzing about Awkward Breeds, finally got a hold of the record, and it instantly blew me away. Like, first listen, fully immersed, fully on board. I knew this was a band I was going to connect with for a long time, and I just listened to this record over and over and over. It was everything I was looking for at that time. It's that weird world we've talked about on other episodes, where it's not too punk, but still squarely punk, and not too indie, but still squarely has some of those vibes, and it just... it hit you in the gut. You could feel it when you see them play live. You know, you could read along and feel it. I just connected with it on so many different levels. Brought them up to Canada to play some shows. Got to know them, and ever since it's been great every single time I run into them. And I was so happy that they had time to sit down with me here. Again, this is another episode filmed spring of 2020, I believe we did it. I think I did this right after Chris Cresswell, Flatliners. Everything was very new. No one really knew what was going on still. I don't think we talk about it much in the episode. I got rid of a lot of that stuff. But there's a ton of great insight here from what they did while writing Awkward Breeds, releasing it on a smaller label like Red Scare, and eventually taking that next step up to Epitaph Records. We get into their time recording Runners in the Nerved World with Phil Eck out in, I believe it's Seattle, and all the way up to Happiness Hours, which if you have not heard Happiness Hours, if somehow you've only heard Awkward Breeds, stop right now, go listen to Happiness Hours. If you haven't heard either of these records, these are two all-timers. And their discography is full of great stuff. Like, I can't say enough great things about this band, but we go pretty much through all of it. Most of the time I'm talking with Steve here, guitar player, singer. We have Sanders and Ryan as well, drums and bass respectively. This was my first audio debacle. I lost the higher quality, my routed audio of Sanders and Ryan, so I had to use some kind of scratchy Skype feed. Sorry about that. I tried to make it as tolerable as possible. That's why we get a majority of Steve here. And I lost the ending on both of them, so it's not a smooth out, but I did my best here with what we had. I was due for, you know, a deleted audio or video or something like that by, you know, seven episodes deep. Regardless, we get to the meat of it. So enjoy. This is all about 2012's Awkward Breeds. So this record then, this was 2012, Awkward Breeds, early February, right? February 21st, is that the sound correct?
That sounds about right to me, yeah.
So you're like three, Weight of Air was 2009, right? So you're about 3 years off of that. And then you add Ryan in between the two records, is that right?
Yep.
How did that happen?
So our old bass player, Josh, who I'd like started the band with, or me, Sanders and Josh and our friend Petey started, he had been like getting kind of more busy with school. He does like industrial design. He actually works for Ford now, like designing trucks.
Oh, damn.
And yeah, so he's doing good, but, he just kind of started to get more and more busy, and we had gotten to a point where like I was going to get out of school, and we like wanted to be able to like start touring more and do more stuff. So it kind of was just like, and Ryan actually filled in for a tour that we had done, I think that's maybe 2009 or 10. And then we kind of play, we wrote the song Little James, which we put on a 7-inch with the split with Tiger's Jaw. And we had been playing that song with Ryan, and he kind of wrote a bass part for it. And then when we went to record it, Josh recorded it, but we sort of had him play what Ryan had been playing in a way. And I feel like that was around the time when it sort of started to switch. We were like, oh, like we had this new thing, and it just the way he plays bass was more of a, just more of like a groove, I guess.
Yeah, he's so that was fucking really good.
Yeah, yeah. So that was around that time when we switched.
Because that's about when the Tiger's Jaw split was when I found you guys basically as well. So yeah, it would have been right around then. And you were already working with Red Scare at that time, right? Like they did Weight of Air.
Yep, and also pretty much, yeah, So Long Soggy Dog, we pressed CDs of, we made 1,000 CDs, and then I think it was the day that I had gotten to school. Like, I moved to Columbus from Cleveland for school, and I was, like, I remember, like, being in the dorms, and I got, like, either a call from Sanders or, like, we got, like, a MySpace message from Brendan Kelly from Lawrence Arms, Red Scare, and he was like, hey, are you guys interested in it? See, it was so weird because you had to, like, go to the MySpace page and be like, is this legit? Like, is this person? And then, yeah, he was like interested. He had heard our CD and was into it, and they like wanted to put it out. So we had to send them all of our CDs. And then Toby from Red Scare put a bunch of like big barcode like stickers on the outsides of the So Long Soggy Dog CDs.
So he'd be in stores and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or like, I think it was like to sell them to Interpunk.com back when that was like.
I used to order from Interpunk all the time.
Yeah, same. Yeah. But I feel like at that time it was even on maybe slightly on the way out, at least in my mind. But it was cool. I mean, it was cool to be able to like just make CDs like that, just sell them. Times are so different now. But yeah, so we started working with Red Scare then, and then they like, then when we did Weight of Air, they like helped fund it, which was, I don't remember what the budget was, but we recorded in like a couple days basically. And then Awkward Breeds, by the time when we were going to write that record, Toby from Red Scare was like, you guys should get on a different label. Like he was like, you guys outgrew this, like you guys need to like do something different. And we at the time we didn't have like a manager. We didn't really know like how to even go about that sort of thing. Like we had friends that would tell us like what you should do. I feel like we were so like we just played DIY punk shows and like would play punk shows at the time. So it wasn't like we had sort of a booking agent, I think, but everything was very like whoever we were friends with, that was who we were working with. So we went in to record Awkward Breeds without a label, and like pretty much we waited up until that point. We wrote all the songs, got into the studio, we were like recording, and then we were just like, well, we need to do something, like we need somebody to put this out. So then we just like asked Toby from Red Scare, and he was like, I mean, I'll do it. Like he was down. And then at the same time we'd been talking to Jeff Rosenstock about he wanted to start releasing records, and he wanted to put the record out. And then we've sort of like split it up between Jeff and Toby because we figured that would give us like a more like broad reach, I guess, of doing like the two things. So Jeff did the vinyl, because at the time Red Scare didn't do vinyl really, except for really special occasions. Sometimes he'd be like, I don't do vinyl, but then all of a sudden you see him like put some 7-inch out. Toby's great.
yeah awesome. So do you remember the writing process from it? Was it like, were you already working on Awkward Breed stuff by the time the world was just seeing Weight of Air, or was there like kind of Weight of Air, you were done, you did some tour stuff, and then you started writing specifically, hey, we're going to do another record?
I think it was, well, after we did the like the Elvis Costello cover and the song Little James, then I think we didn't really start writing the songs for Awkward Breeds until Ryan had started playing with us. And I know that we did some tours like where we were playing like a lot of songs that would end up being on Awkward Breeds. We just would play new songs live like all the time, much to like our label's dismay, or just anybody that would go to a show and be like, why don't you guys play the songs people know? But it's fun at the time just to like figure songs out. And I think that informed the writing of Awkward Breeds a lot, because it was like seeing what stuff was just like working really well. Because I think the song Whale and Jonah we had already written, which like, but we're playing that live and we're like, oh, this is cool. Having this like loud I got a rat pedal, you know, the
distortion
rat pedal. So I got a rat pedal and had that with a tube screamer. So that was like kind of this fuzzy sound. And I was like, oh, this fuzzy thing. That was like, I guess, new to that record. And playing that stuff live was really fun because it's just loud and really like just sustain-y. So I think then after that, that sort of led to like writing some other songs on that record.
Do you guys write as a group, or are you bringing like skeletons basically to practice?
I generally am like writing the lyrics and the melodies and like the chords on my own, and I have like, we'll have a rough idea of like some sort of structure, but I think usually what ends up happening is it's like things are sort of left open, like this, the beginnings and endings, and like just feeling out like how it feels as we're playing it. Cause a lot of times what everyone else starts playing, like that'll inform, like just kind of fill in like in between the singing parts, I guess. Like if someone's doing something cool melodically or anything like that. So it's collaborative in the way of just playing the song itself, I guess. But generally like the chords and that kind of stuff, that's where I like start out with it.
And so you guys recorded this in Ohio. Is that correct? The Tone Shop, I believe it's called.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Our friend Eric Kronstein, he recorded Weight of Air, and I think we met him the day that we were recording Weight of Air, through our friend Andy Cook, who also was like helping us with that record. We recorded Weight of Air in like a couple days, but then like after that, Eric went on to record like a lot of our other friends' bands. I think he did Tin Armor, and I'm pretty sure he did Delay like before we went and did Arbor Breeze. And he did Saint Seneca, the first Saint Seneca record, last. So he was just kind of doing all of our friends' bands in that whole scene, usually at this place, the Tone Shop. So he got this studio that was like had already existed, and he like started just renting it out or like lived there. And it was a great space. It had like a big live room, and he like had like a cool board. I don't know what it was, but yeah, he had like a lot of nice gear, and it was like very affordable at the time. Like, I mean, we paid out of pocket, and it was fun too, because we got to stay at the studio, even though it was in Columbus. It was like 15 minutes from our house. We just like stayed there and just hung out like for the 10 days that we were recording it. So it like felt like it was very like transformative thing, because it's like you go in, no records made, you leave, it's like, oh, we did something.
Garrick was a good buddy of ours, and he had just recently started renting out this house that also had like a large studio attached to it. And I think for us, it was just like, he made records that sounded good, and we also like, it was like the perfect situation. Basically, he had a full setup, and we had never really had an actual studio to record a record in.
Yeah. And it was kind of a natural progression, because you all, like Sanders, you guys did, Weight of Air with Andy Cook, correct?
Yeah, Andy and Eric, actually. But yeah, that Eric didn't have a space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then we just like decided, since Eric got the space in South Columbus, that would be convenient and just kind of a good place to record. It sounded great. It was a nice big room and wasn't far from home, but we really just camped out at the studio for like, I don't even know, 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think it was like, I think tracking was like 7 or 8 days, and then mixing. I had to split after we got done tracking, and I tried to make it down for some of the mixing, but I don't think I was really able to. I was having to work a bunch, but yeah, we had already established that relationship with Eric, like from doing Weight of Air, and we had a really good time doing that. So I think it was all the more exciting for us to like have a batch of songs that we're going to be able to record in like a much better studio setting with an engineer that we already knew and liked a lot.
Yeah. That's, I feel like that's a real like underrated way, especially now with the ability of so many people to like home record, to like, people can really like, I've done albums before where it's like, we recorded ourselves, and it was like, when it's all done, you're like, we really drag this out, and like, really, like, it's easy to really overkill something. Whereas when you just like go to the studio, you're like immersed in that, especially when you stay there like that, where you're just like, you have one task and it's really all you're focused on the whole time. And this is like 2011, right? You would be recording it. So like, it's not like everyone's on their phones and stuff as much as it would be now. Like it's a different experience.
Yeah. I think Sanders had the BlackBerry at the time. He was always up on the
Canada represent.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that record, especially, we were like, we tried to do a lot of things live. And I think like that was sort of the whole vibe of it, was it was like, just capturing like specific moments. Like it was like everything was captured in that room. Like we had room mics up and pretty much left them up like the whole time. And I don't remember like specifically like how we had it all like set up, but I know that like for vocals, we had the room mics up, and like for songs like 1940s Fighter Jet, I was like, oh, I want to just open this door up and just have my amp be in the room, and we won't use the direct signal of the amp. I don't even think we would make the decisions as we're recording it and like not even have the option to like, oh, we're going to use this other mic. And like when we did the drums, it was like, oh, we're going to do this. Like I saw that they recorded In Utero this way. And I was like, I remember driving to get drum heads. And I was like, Eric, I read about this drum miking technique. We should try this. And then we just like, that was the drum miking.
Went with it. Yeah.
For the record. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes those little accidents like end up just being awesome, or like putting some kind of your own restriction on it. Cause so many times you'd be like, oh, we'll fix that in mixing. Oh, we'll do this in mixing or whatever. But it's like to just commit to something, be like, that's the sound.
Yeah, definitely. It was very, at the time I was really into the room mics. I was like, why would you ever record without room mics? Just put room mics on everything. It's like, it's like, you know, in moderation, it's good, but I think that's what gives it, when I've listened back, it gave it a cool like sense of space, I guess.
When you were going into Awkward Breeds, what kind of personal expectations did you have on that recording? Like, were you hoping, like you guys had just kind of added Ryan, were you hoping this was like, we're going to put this record out and kind of try and do touring as full time as we possibly can?
Yeah, for sure. That was our hope, was because up until then it had to be like in between like school breaks pretty much. So that was like, we were like, we're going to put this record out. And I think we started recording it, like, I think it was right after I graduated. Like maybe we started recording it like a week or two after I graduated college. And then I think we went on like a really long tour with Bomb Music Industry like that summer, like while like Awkward Breeds had been recorded, but it wasn't out yet. But yeah, we weren't like career driven, I guess, but we were just like, we want to play music as much as we can. So that was like, I guess, the hope with the record. And it was, but also like, we didn't really have like a big push in any other way. Like it wasn't like, oh, we had some label knocking on our door, or like all these other tours lined up. Like it was still just like talking to friends and planning out tours that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, you guys came to Canada when I just hit you up randomly via email.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, because that was basically, I had heard Awkward Breeds, and I was like instantly just, it was the only thing I listened to for so long, and it was, I was just trying to do shows, and so I hit up you guys, and I hit up Hop Along for, this was also before they were on Saddle Creek or anything like that. They were kind of just like starting to blow up.
Yeah.
And you guys came. We did I think we just did like Guelph, Toronto, maybe Kitchener, Montreal. We just did like a couple shows, and like Hop Along missed the first one with a van thing. But that was I was just kind of hitting up bands randomly, and occasionally they get back to me. And then, you know, we'd have these fun shows. So, yeah, obviously you weren't working with like a booking agent, like legit yet.
I'm not sure yet. We started working with people around when Awkward Breeds came out, but yeah. But yeah, I think at the time we were like, we were taking playing music seriously for sure. Like with making that record, like it was definitely all that I would think about. Like, even though it's like, you're going to school, but it was like very honed in, focused on like writing and recording this record.
I feel like at this point we're all like, hitting it like really hard. Like we were making a point to just be practicing like every weekend. I feel like it was a really cool time in Columbus and kind of just in Ohio in general, because there were so many great bands and the scenes were both like really thriving at that time. I felt like, between Tin Armor and Delay, like you had all of these bands, a ton of different bands between the two cities and Cincinnati as well. But you had bands that were just kind of pushing each other. Like you would just kind of push yourselves, just seeing what other people were putting out and just wanting to, you know, continue to like just master your craft or just continue to hone in on it. And so I feel like this was probably the most focused record we had made to that point. And like adding Ryan to the band was a big boost. Like he's a fantastic musician, like an amazing bass player. So it was like, just to have a new person in the mix makes it even more exciting, I think. And I think it was really when Steve had kind of like was really coming into his own as a songwriter too. So it was kind of just a perfect storm, I think, of just creatively working really well together and then just continuing to grow as musicians.
Yeah, I feel like you kind of hit the nail on the head, Sanders, when you said like when you were talking about the scene, like the Ohio scene. It was just like a lifestyle. I feel like everyone, like there were shows all the time, and that's just what we wanted to focus on individually and like as a band, and just kind of like become competent musicians and, you know, just kind of do our part to like entertain our friends and just like have fun parties and fun shows and stuff. But I think we definitely pushed each other, at, you know, even the four of us in the band, to kind of do the best that we could personally, you know.
Do you remember just looking at the track listing here, do you remember kind of what stuff came early in the songwriting process and kind of started to shape the direction? Like you were talking about playing Whale and Jonah live, because I feel like there's like a, this is really like the Sidekick sound. Like you had like one kind of, it's not like concept record-y, but like one kind of sound to this album.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's just the recording or maybe it was just, was it written close together?
I think that the cohesiveness of the recording is like we played it all in this room, like didn't change amp settings, didn't change really anything. We just played through the songs and then kind of like peppered in production stuff on top of that. Because in my mind, like the songs themselves, in my mind, they're very different. But when like the band itself, like when we would perform the songs, like I think that was always the strength and maybe sometimes like weakness of the band, is that it's like no matter what, it's going to be us. Like you can't like make it into something that it's not. Like it just sounds like the Sidekicks. So certain songs we had a few songs written. I feel like this is always how it would go, is like we'd start writing songs and like two out of the first four would just get scrapped because it would just sort of be like, oh, this isn't working, and I'd just be like trying to do some like weird, there was like one song that was very almost like Fleet Foxes-y, like it was like, oh, we're gonna layer all these harmonies. And when we tried to do it, it just, like, didn't really mesh with, like, just the loud rock vibe of the band. And I don't think it was that good of a song. But then I know Incandescent Days was maybe the first song that we sort of worked on as a band, which is funny because it's probably, like, it started out more complex in a way. Like, that song's got, like, several parts. And then Whale and Jonah was also near to the beginning of that. With all the writing.
What was your approach for sequencing the record? Like, how much do you guys work on that as a band, or like as you're going, like when did you kind of know the order?
I usually, depends like record to record, but even with So Long Soggy Dog, I was like writing songs specifically for order. Like I think it's just how I just compartmentalize the writing process, and like sometimes too, like you don't want to like waste your time, or like you're even at the time too, like with lyrics, like I would only have so many lyrics or like ideas kind of in my notebook, and I'd like would want to pair it with like the best possible riff or melody or like chord progression. So I never wanted to like waste something. So I always wanted to know if it was going to be like, well, we've got enough like mid-tempo things, so I don't want to like turn this idea into that. So I was always like just kind of cognizant of like what's going to be first song, what's going to be last song, like on all pretty much all the records up until Happiness Hours was a little more like kind of flowy, like wasn't, I mean, it's like sometimes you write a song and it just like seems like it'll fit, but awkward. I try to like answer like a million things at once.
It's all good, man. No, but you get interesting tidbits that way.
Yeah. But with Awkward Breeds, actually it was like, we had the sort of like bulk of it written, like maybe I had like 8 songs or so. What is it? 11 songs, right? So I think we had 8 songs written. And then it was like, I feel like, cause at the time I was like, oh, maybe Grace will be the first song. And then I was like, oh, we got to write like a few more songs. And I think around that time, I don't know if we had all those written, but we had a good chunk. And I just remember like we had played Whale and Jonah live a bunch. And I was like, oh, we need a few more songs that are like this level, like hit this kind of level of like just the noisy, fuzzy stuff. So then I wrote Daisy. And then I'm pretty sure DMT was the last song we wrote, like jammed on as a band. Yeah, it was like really fast. Like, I think maybe Daisy was the last song we did, because I think it was like very fresh, but like DMT and Daisy were the last two. And it was like, all right, this will be first song, this will be last song on the record. And so it was like, you knew like with Daisy, like it was like, all right, it's going to be this really like kind of epic jam.
Close it out.
Yeah. And then the first, like, and then DMT was kind of trying to hit a similar note as like the ninth piece or something, where it was like, just like a all loud cymbals, like super chunk kind of thing.
And now DMT, did you have the album title already, or did you get Awkward Breeds from writing DMT?
That was just like I don't know if the album was totally titled yet. Like I had done a bunch of just like free form writing, I guess. Just thinking about themes, and then a lot of lyrics to the songs kind of came from that. And the See the Sowing of Awful Seeds.
What is it? Awkward Breeds.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. How many times have you played that song?
Yeah. But that line was like came from that. And so I was like, all right, where am I gonna put this? So it just kinda worked out. It wasn't like a chorus, but I feel like it has a good spot, like right at the start of the record.
Yeah, I like it as kind of like, here's your like thesis statement, and then everything follows in line quite nicely.
Yeah. In writing that record, I was like, oh, this is such a, like, I wanted it to be this really cohesive, like, almost like, not like concept record, but I wanted it to have like a conceptual through line. And then I feel like, but when you play the songs, like sometimes people pick up on that, but all that really matters is just like kind of the feeling of it and like what you're saying. It's not like, I don't know, like an individual song can be really cool when it's like placed in the context of a big concept, but I feel like sometimes with writing it can almost be like a hindrance to try to be like forcing something to fit into like this concept necessarily. But I don't think that record suffers from that, but I just, thinking back, it's funny because I was just, it was like trying to make it just really conceptually solid, but I think that it's, now looking back on it, I don't think it is that solid, because whenever I had to talk about it after the fact, I don't think I could really explain it that well. So I was like, well, if it was like about a guy going to the moon, I would be able to just tell people that. But it's, I don't know, a little more. It's just like, really, it's just a record. So it's not a concept record, but I tried.
Now, looking at kind of the first half of the record, now 1940s Fighter Jet has become kind of, I would say, the fan favorite, and you guys play it pretty often still. You play it pretty much every set?
We had been for a long time, and actually Danielle, who tour manages Sidekicks, she was like, are you guys going to play this song every set? Like, she kind of she kind of gave us shit. She just was like tired of hearing the same song. And then I think we kind of like took it out of the set. And I think there was maybe like a time we didn't have it in the set list for some show. And then we got an encore. And I remember like everyone in the crowd was getting really into it, and I saw her in the crowd. I made eye contact with her, and I winked at her.
Yeah, and she was furious.
It's funny. It's one of those songs, like, sometimes it works, and sometimes it's like, I don't know. I almost feel like it's like kind of awkward or something.
Yeah, I feel like it's like a delicate, like it could definitely be like an energy sucker.
Yeah.
But I think especially like shows where you guys are headlining, like people are there to see you, I feel like it's always a huge hit. Even when you were like, I think the last time I saw you was on that Oso Oso little mini tour type thing.
Yeah.
And that was like definitely a different crowd than I'd seen you guys play in front of before. And I think it still hit pretty well in that context too.
Yeah. I like playing it. I like the dynamic shift in the set. That's always nice.
Yeah. Cause it's definitely my favorite song on the record. Was there any point during the writing process where you're like, maybe this doesn't fit with like the kind of rocking nature of the rest of the album? Or were you always like, oh, this is like a nice gem for breaking up, or just like a solid song? Like, was there any apprehension?
I don't think so. It was kind of like a chord and like music idea first. And it was that and Diamond Eyes just all together. Like I just had, because it was in this different tuning, and I kind of just had these two, like, just song ideas, kind of like, I would just kind of hum over it. But I was like, oh, this will be a cool part of a record where it just, like, the whole record was, we really were, like, trying to make it flow super well. Like, just we would know, like, which songs were going to go into each one. And I think when we recorded them, like, I mean, we did the ending of 1940s Fighter Jet and then just played Diamond Eyes like just into each other. And then like, yeah, just trying to do like as much of the like flow, I guess, of it. But I think I felt good about that song going into it. I forget if we had like tried it as like the band playing it without me like just playing and singing the first half, but like the build and then everybody kicking in and then it kind of going to this other song, I think like, that was always, it was pretty exciting and like a nice kind of change of pace for the record.
Yeah, one thing, like talking about the loose kind of conceptual thing, like you kind of have like a, I think Grace kind of sums it up, the line, the adult life's a burning, a bonfire burning, you've got to keep a couple feet away to keep from hurting. Where it's kind of like this growth type thing, but I want to kind of ask now as you look back on this record, basically, recently 8 years, I guess 8 years this past February, how do you look back at it at that time? Like you were kind of sorting through this, like it seemed like adult life limbo, like you were talking about just kind of finishing college, trying to do this band thing, and 8 years later you're still doing this band, you're still touring pretty heavily. Do you still feel these same themes, or have you kind of made up your mind on certain things, or are they, you know, like where are you at now, basically 8 years later, looking back on some of this stuff?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it's just like, I think I just look at things different, but maybe not in that different of a way where it's like, oh, I was so naive, I was so young, and now like I'm really serious about what I'm doing. I think I still have like, because I'm still playing music, I think I just approach it with this way that's not, maybe not necessarily tied to like it as a career, but I'm trying to be better about doing that. But yeah, I don't know. I think like, I feel like in ways it still, I guess, rings true to me, like now in a way, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I just feel like it's just feels different, but not like I don't agree with the lyrics now or something.
Did you have like a vision artwork wise going into it, or how did the artwork come about? Because you did the 7-inch as well before that had like the deer on the cover, if I'm remembering it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of stayed with the same theme or same kind of look. Was that just the same artist, or was that you had like kind of a concept of visually what you wanted to accompany the record?
So Zach Little, who plays in St. Seneca, and also at the time we had all been living together at this house, the Monster House, and but yeah, it's Zach's art, and he has like, he had a lot of paintings of that style just kind of hung up like in our house. Like he had one with like a panther, and I think there was another one, maybe like a tiger, like the same like kind of like paint. It was like he would take picture, like big posters or like photos that he would find at thrift stores and then paint on top of them. So that was kind of that. So then I was like, oh, would you want to do one of those for our record? And so he did the deer. Like we found some at thrift, like he found a deer and we found a bald eagle. And I was like, oh man, the bald eagle's kind of funny, but it ended up turning out really sweet. And it was like, oh, that actually, maybe it's like just like kind of crazy enough to be like the perfect thing for the record. And then for the back, we're like, and then you, then he painted on top of like a photo of us too, to kind of like,
yeah, I'm looking at that now.
All cohesive. Yeah. So it was Zach's art. And I think I was just like sitting around and then I was like, oh, what if we had like one of these, like just looked like that. And like the panther one he has is awesome, but it almost like we wanted it to be at least like somehow tied into like what the record was. And then Zach also did like all of the layout and like the text and all that stuff too for the record.
So you just had basically the artist you like. It wasn't like you came in and you had this idea of like an eagle thematically fitting with the record or anything like that.
No, but I think that it like fed into kind of, I think, some themes on the record and like ideas that like to me, it like just fit like in terms of like kind of trying to like, I feel like with the record, it was sort of trying to look at like just the ways that maybe like outside things are sort of like shape you like into being who you are, or like things trying to shape people into being something that they don't want to be, and like all that. I don't know, just like, and in my mind, the colors sort of like around it was like symbolic in a way. And then maybe just the whole act itself of like the painting on top of this thing, like, you know, tied in with the record. Yeah, I don't know if it makes it cooler or less cool, because I'm sure people have their own like ideas about it. But that was how I sort of like envisioned it. It was like, oh, this is cool for this reason.
Was there any songs on this? You know, sometimes like you go into the studio and you either think like one song is great, or maybe you think, oh, we're going to cut this song. And then after you actually do the recording, like something surprised you. Were there any like that when you did this record?
Not really, because it was cut so live that it was just like,
this is what you were playing. Like, yeah.
Yeah, like you'd kind of like get the take and it was like, oh, sweet, we got it. And like a lot of like the solos and stuff were like not written. It just was like happening. Like they would change each time. I mean, there's not a ton of guitar soloing, but you know,
well, there's some just big, like little, some little big ones. The Whale and Jonah one.
Yeah, yeah. Like that one, it was like, oh, I flubbed that, but it was like, you're not. It was like, no, you're not gonna like overdub that guitar solo. So there was like, I think there was more like, there wasn't really like any like bummer, like, oh, this didn't really turn out. Maybe the song Looker we had to do in a very fast fashion in a way, because we didn't get to that in the initial tracking. And then I kind of had to like hang out until Eric had some more free time in the studio. And we just like cut it really fast. And I like was like, I want to record it through, I want to sing into a mic that goes into the guitar amp with a delay pedal on it. So that was how we recorded it. Yeah. It was like went into it with all these ideas, I guess, where I was like, all right, bass, we should record into a guitar. We should record the bass into a twin reverb. It was like all these like kind of like rules. I didn't really know about recording, but I knew that I wanted it to have like just like kind of different aspects than like, I don't know, like a really clean, polished sort of presentation. Purposeful, what do you say? Like, I don't know, obstructions, I guess.
I don't think I realized at the time that Incandescent Days would be appreciated by listeners as much as it was.
Yeah.
And now looking back, I'm like, man, that's still like one of my favorite songs to like play. And I feel like a really good song that we wrote. I feel like the big controversy was Toby from Red Scare really wanted the Wallflowers on the record, which ended up being a B-side on the Grace EP.
Yeah.
Grace single. And I was really stoked about that song because it was just really something different in terms of what we were doing stylistically. But it just didn't fit anywhere. And I feel like ultimately we made the right call on that, because I just like still like looking back on the record or listening to it, I just don't know where it would go. But that was a song that I wish could have been on the record. I feel like it's a really cool fucking song, but it didn't have a place there.
Yeah. Was there any outside input on people saying to maybe take songs out to fit things in?
Yeah, Toby wanted to I can't remember what the song was that he wanted to cut and put Wallflowers in.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's been too long.
I know. There was one though. And I think
Steve seemed to think it was 1940.
I think that's right, actually.
Oh man. What a different record.
Yeah, right? Be a wild one. Because that goes right into Diamond Eyes too, so it basically it would basically eliminate both of those songs. That or we would have really had to done some last minute fuckery to make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because those songs have always been like paired, you know, in our eyes, like 1940s Diamond Eyes, even like DMT into Grace and like Whale into Ninth Piece. Yeah. Those are all like the pairings. I feel like so to separate them or eliminate one would be like getting half the story or something.
For sure.
But the one that I guess came out to the biggest surprise would be Daisy. Because, I mean, we just like went in there and like hammered it out and it came out. You know, I think it's like definitely the best possible like climax or just kind of like final song on the album.
Totally.
But I would say Daisy has like surprised me at the end the most.
So do you remember after this record came out, the reception wise, were you surprised? Were you guys happy? Like what did that feel like? Did it feel like it kind of like took off the way you wanted it to?
I think like the experience of making the album and then just like kind of like committing this whole idea into this physical form. Like, I feel like that felt like the most triumphant aspect of the whole process. Like, even just making the recordings themselves, not even like finishing the album itself, but it was like, I felt like we had this thing that existed, and that was like, that was probably the most exciting part out of all of it. And then after that, then that's kind of when it's like, no matter what, I feel like you'll just still want to be, you'll want more, like you'll want to be like satiated, I guess. And in a, like, no matter how many people come out to the show, you're like, oh, you're like, it's like, people start to expect more people, like that many people are going to come to your show the next time. It's like, and you try to stay like level headed, but I just feel like, I don't know, like with expectations of that kind of stuff, I just always try to just be like, I don't know, just kind of, it's just going to be what it's going to be. And a lot of it feels like it's like out of your hands. So I'm just happy that anybody here, like, I feel lucky that we had like a platform to like present our music and we like got to play shows and play the songs like all around the world, really. So I feel like that was like a success in that regard. So it felt like, I think it felt really good. Those songs were always like, sometimes when you put a record out, it doesn't always feel like immediately it like hits live, but that record, it was like immediately like we could play those songs live and it was like they would go over really well. So that was like a good sign.
Are you the people that kind of seek out reviews and see what people saying on it, or do you just kind of ignore that stuff or try and roll with it? Like, how do you feel about those types of things, and has that changed as you put more albums out?
I feel like I've it's changed a little bit. I think during Awkward Breeds, I was like pretty heavy into like reading reviews because you're just excited. Like, you're excited to see what people have to say about it. Over the years, I don't know, you have to go into it with the mindset that like the listener is a listener. So just don't take it personally if they have negative things to say about it, or maybe there are things that you're like, oh, damn. All right, cool. I don't know. I like looking at them. It's never really bugged me either way, because my thought on it is just like, we made a record that we were really proud of, and I made, you know, I personally was really proud of all of the records that we've made. And so wherever it goes from there, then that's fine. But I don't feel like I don't know. They've never really affected
me. Yeah. Yeah, like, the first person you have to make happy is yourself. So if you're happy with the album, then, you know, that's the way I'm going to think about it, you know? And so I like watching or, like, listening or reading reviews and stuff just because it's like, wow, these people put thought into our music. That's pretty cool. Whether it's good or bad, I mean, I really take it with a grain of salt, I guess, you know, because at the end I'm like, yeah, I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's pretty interesting sometimes. I wish people would get, like, more in-depth about it, but...
Yeah, sure. I feel like that's... Yeah, that can be, like, the one hard thing is you read 9 reviews and 8 of them just seem like they went off of what the first one said or something like that, and you're kind of left with this very short sample size, like, somewhat vapid review of something that has a lot more to it than,
yeah,
than what's out there. You know, everything's going to be critiqued and everything's going to be reviewed in some sort of matter, so let it still be, I suppose.
That's awesome. So you put this out, comes out on Red Scare and Really Records, and I remember a funny moment talking to you guys after, because this was back when, like, Side One Dummy was, like, really doing a lot of stuff, and I remember they just tweeted out, like, a couple of lyrics from different songs just, like, on their Twitter.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, like, talking to Sanders, like, the next time I saw him, I was like, holy shit, man, like, are you guys gonna sign to Side One? And he's like, well, we're talking to, like, you know, a few labels, whatever. And at the time, I was like, what could be bigger than Side One? And then it was like Runners gets announced coming out on Epitaph. I was like, oh, okay, that could definitely be bigger.
Yeah, the backstory with that, we were, like, talking to Side One Dummy about working together, but I almost feel like the conversations we had were, like, almost maybe a little too nebulous. And on their end, they thought we had made a commitment. And on our end, we just were like, they're just kind of, like, helping us out right now. We haven't signed anything because they had, like, helped us do some distribution stuff in Europe and were expecting us to do a record with them. And we were kind of, like, just trying to shop around because we're like, well, we've never really done a whole like a real legit record thing. And in the end, we, like, working with them, like, would have been awesome. And, but I don't know. It just, like, kind of worked out better to do it with Epitaph, with what we were, like, hoping to accomplish with the next record.
When did Epitaph come into the picture?
We had some demos that we had done, and we just sort of were sending them around to different labels, and I think our manager at the time had hit up Epitaph maybe before we had the demos, but they sort of, like, were interested based off of hearing Awkward Breeds, which that was cool to be like, oh, you guys heard this. Thinking back now, I'm like, of course they heard it. They, like, know what's going on. Like, everyone that works there, it's, like, literally their job.
That's
to know
job,
what,
yeah,
what music is going on. And we had been touring with the Menzingers, who had put a record out on an Epitaph, but it's still flattering.
I remember having a really awesome tour with Menzingers and Cheap Girls at the time. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Menzingers were really taking off. All three of our records came out on the same day. All three of our bands had known each other for a long time, and that was, like, a blast. It was so much fun. I remember kind of feeling like, all right, our audience has widened at this point. Like, I feel like it was the first time we saw, like, some, like, legit, like, growth, you would say, you know, like, you're playing shows and you're seeing more kids sing along and know about the record. I don't know. It was the first time, I guess. Yeah. We had, like, a little buzz, I guess, going on.
Yeah.
Toby basically from Red Scare, he, like, approached us and was like, hey, I don't think you should do the next record with me. I think you should, like, look elsewhere because why not? And so we kind of just started to, and then Epitaph approached us from there, and we went out and met with them and really enjoyed, like, talking to them, and seemed like it was the next logical step. So it was pretty surreal, like, meeting Brett and, like, flying out there and just being like, okay, yeah, I've been a Bad Religion fan since I was, like,
yeah,
15 years old, you know? But everyone there was so nice, and they were all really stoked on the band. It was just, like, that's all we've tried to do is just work with people that wanted to work with us and that were excited about the project that we were working on.
Yeah, definitely simpler times, like doing Awkward Breeds. Just because, definitely had like the power of the scene behind us. But, you know, after all that kind of fizzled out, like all those Soggy Dog and Monster House stopped doing shows, everybody moved out and like went their own way. I feel like that's when we were just like, well, we just have to like take the reins on our band, you know, and like kind of just like take control and do kind of just ride the wave, you know, like to take into consideration all the opportunities that kind of came our way and, you know, picked which ones we thought worked best for us and just didn't have any like inhibitions or like let anything hold us back. We, you know, just kind of like, oh, okay. Like Epitaph, truly surreal at the time, you know, but sure, let's do that, you know.
Also, like, that's what we got a booking agent during this period, and we started playing more shows that were in venues as opposed to like DIY spots. And like, there was a lot of change, I guess. We started eventually ended up like working with a manager for the first time. So I guess it was like the first time that like we had some sort of like semblance of like the biz or like kind of getting into the machine that is like the music industry and touring in venues and shit like that.
Do you have any like favorite tours or memories from this album cycle? Did you guys not do a bunch of dates with Against Me during this time, or was that after Runners?
That was we had already kind of talked to Epitaph about working together, and we had written Runners when we were touring with Against Me, and we had been shopping those or like talking to different producers, and like I had a conversation with like with some different producers on that Against Me tour, which I was like super stoked about, just being like, who are we gonna record with? Felt very like special at the time. Now looking back, I'm just like, yeah, that's what people who record do. They record bands that they don't know all of the time. They hear your demos and they're like, cool, sounds like I could make this sound cool.
I could do this, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I still like, I really value the experiences I've had just like working in different studios with different producers. Like I just, in a way, I feel like we entered those situations like wanting to learn things as well. Like recording with Philek, I think we just became such a better band and such better musicians, just like seeing just like a really meticulously made record, like how that process kind of goes and what goes into it and like what your ideas of that and like then how that actually is. It's like so different. Like I thought it was like, oh, to make a record that sounds really slick, you just like someone just kind of moves everything around the computer and makes it that way. It's like, no, every single sound that's on that record like sounded like that when we recorded it, and we just sat there until we got it to sound exactly right and then played it until it was exactly right and like sang it exactly right. And it's like really stressful in a way, but in the end you go, that's like the standard that every like, I don't know, like that's like pop standards really. So it was cool to like see that kind of side of the process after doing Awkward Breeds, which was like, we were like, no, don't. It was like the first take of 1940s Fighter Jet, and my voice cracks on the You Still Like to Kiss Me part, and I was like so pissed because I was like, because we were like, oh, we gotta wait to this song, this one's gonna be tricky. Like turned all the lights off, and I think I recorded it like no one else was in the studio except Eric, and it was just me, and I had all the lights off, and it just was like, I did the one take. And then we showed everybody and everyone was like, I don't know. But I feel like me and Eric were both like, no, we were there. Like, this was this moment. Like, this is what, this just worked. Like, I don't think and I did a couple more takes and it just was like, not, it just wasn't happening. So I feel like that was what was always cool. When I listen back to that record, I just like, I remember like the specific takes of each song, which I feel like I can't necessarily say for like, not like every other record or something.
I think the recording of that record in general was just so much fucking fun. Like there's a couple of videos on YouTube, I think, of like,
yes. Oh yeah.
And I look back at that session like really fondly, because I feel like we were all constantly laughing a lot in the past.
Yeah.
So laid back and just really natural, and we all just fuck around all the time. It was, I guess watching those videos sometimes I'm like, I can't believe we actually made a record.
Yeah, much more carefree, very fun. Yeah, it was a good time.
The two LPs you've done since this, how is those recording processes different? Is that, you didn't have like a third party producer come in on this, it looks like, from the notes or anything like that, eh?
No, I mean, Eric definitely produced it. Like we had like notions of like what we wanted to be like. Like we were like, we like Pinkerton, we like Nirvana, but like not, I had like ideas about sound, like what I wanted things to sound like, but it wasn't like, none of us had any sort of like engineering know-how. So Eric was very much like producing it, and he does a good job with like, I'd want to redo a song or like redo like a vocal, and he'd be like, no, that was it. Like he was on the same page with like keeping things really like trying to capture like the moment and the vibe more so than like this like really honed in like performance or like perfect sort of thing. Cause I feel like that when I like, there's all sorts of like mistakes, but then now when you listen back, like those are the parts that you kind of like laugh, or it's like, I enjoy it, I guess, now.
Right, right. Did you guys then travel for Runners and Happiness Hours? Like, you went somewhere else for those recordings, did you not, or?
Yep, yeah, so Runners in the Nerd World we did in Seattle with Phil Eck.
Oh, okay.
And then Happiness Hours was with John and Yellow, and that was in New York and then New Jersey.
Right, right. I guess, yeah, because that was the switch to Epitaph as well, right? Runners, that was the first one on Epitaph?
Yep. Sweet. Yeah, for sure. And that was kind of like, when we went to sign with Epitaph, we had a conversation with Brett from Epitaph, and he was like, who would you want to work with? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I have ideas, but some of these people, I don't think that we would be able to like work with. But he's like, oh, I don't know. Just name them. And I was like, well, number one would be Phil Eck. And then we kind of like went through talking to a lot of other different producers, but then eventually Phil like got back to us and heard the demos and was into it. So we ended up, it was like, oh, we have to do this. So it was kind of weird to like have that like how I was talking about how we had no know-how of like how anything really worked back when we were doing Awkward Breeds. I feel like around that time it was like realizing just like you just have to like hit people up, and sometimes they'll just respond to you and be like, yeah, I play music too, or I record music, I'll work with your band. Like, it's as simple as that. Like, it's not, I mean, we got lucky, and we also had people on our team and like this really big label like backing us up, so that was what allowed it to happen. But yeah, very different. That was a very different kind of approach, I guess, to it all. That was like big time record making versus Awkward Breeds. It was like, our friend has a studio, like, let's just make something.
When you worked with Phil Eck, was it all like tracked to a click, like individually?
Yeah, we recorded live together, but then we tracked pretty much what he kept was just the drums from the initial tracking, but we were all playing together as he was doing the drums. But I feel like we weren't really ready to play all those songs live together at that time. Like, I just don't think we had like played to the click and stuff, but that was the first record we ever did to a click, so it was just like a different kind of vibe.
Yeah, definitely, for
and,
sure.
Like, I ended up like getting my guitar set up like out in Seattle, and just like went completely broke trying to get my guitar like set up in a good way that it was like intonated okay, like pretty much up to Phil's standards, which was good because after that it was like it played amazing.
Was it the Gibson, the double cut?
Yeah. It was just funny because I feel like I had gotten it set up before I went out, then we got it set up by somebody that was out there, then when we went to play it, it was still kind of like pulling a little bit, like just not intonating well enough, just would sound out of tune. He'd be like, sounds a little off. He's just really like, he just notices. He's just like,
ear.
If it's not, yeah, he's like, if it's not in tune, it's not going to sound musical, and it's not going to sound like I feel like his philosophy is like, I mean, I won't speak for him, but what I gathered from it was like all of those little things that kind of like add up. It's like, people maybe won't notice what it is, but subconsciously they'll notice this little thing that's like irking them maybe, or like, oh, this one note's like a little off. Like in general, like that's why I don't know, like I'll hear records that people really love and I'll be like, I can tell this is auto-tuned, but the general public is just enjoying this song, you know? But that, I mean, that record, we didn't like auto-tune stuff, but it was like, instead you just sit there and like sing it over and over and over again until it's like sounds good. But I mean, either way, it's like a virtual representation. It's not like this live performance.
I know from my personal experience, like the first day we had like a long day, as you typically do, setting up and getting tones for the drums. And I kept like knocking the snare drum out of tune. And so it felt like we were never going to fucking, and Phil's like really meticulous. So it felt like we were never going to start tracking. And probably, I think it was about 7 hours in, he's like, all right, I think we're about ready to start tracking. And I was like, all right, cool. And he's like, what song do you want to do? I was like, all right, let's do Deer. Cause I was like, all right, that one's like pretty straightforward. It's my first time recording to a click. I'd practiced to a click while we were rehearsing a bunch and felt confident. And then, I just remember doing like six or seven takes of it and him just being like, you know what, we should come back to this tomorrow. And like, that felt so deflating. And then I was just like, the rest of that night, I was just like, this is fucking bad. Like, I'm going to like dismantle this record for us because I can't fucking play drums. And so, yeah, I think there was like, it's definitely, I don't know. This is a guy who like did all of the Built to Spill records that I love and so many Modest Mouse records, and just like, it's an intimidating situation to be in. And I think I tend to put pressure on myself regardless. So I know from my personal experience, yes, it was a little stressful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest thing going into the situation, like the difference of Awkward Breeds to Runners. The hardest thing was getting comfortable while recording with Runners, because yeah, we had that extra pressure working with Phil, someone with like a lot of clout, you know, someone we looked up to, really like wanted to do the record with him. We sought him out. And when we finally got out of our heads, you know, like not thinking, and instead of thinking, like we were feeling the music, and that's when the good, like the keepers came out, like the good takes, the ones that we went with. So that's the hardest thing. Like you know, you got to get your headset right, hear what you want to hear, get comfortable, and then just like don't think about anything, which is hard as hell, you know. So but that's what you got to do.
How different was it going then from Phil Eck to John? John, how do you say Agnello? Is that
Agnello? It was almost a similar vibe to doing Awkward Breeds. Like we recorded that record in, I think, like a similar amount of time, like about 2 weeks and then a few days to mix. And he was like, we set our stuff up and then I feel like we tracked like two or three songs like the first day. Like usually we thought it'd be like, all right, first day you're always just like trying to get drum sounds and everyone's just like, you think you're gonna record, and then like it's like 10 o'clock and it's like, well, guess we'll just get started tomorrow. And it's like, ah, yeah. But he just like he's just got it down. Like he just knows what, I don't know. I feel, and the place we were recording at, Water Music in Hoboken, he had been working out of there for a long time and like just knows the room and like just knows what he's hearing and like what he needs to be hearing. And it was that record, we used all of our own gear like to start with, and he was like, all right, cool, I just mic'd up our amps, and so we knew what we were using, so we weren't like fiddling around with different stuff. The drums weren't Sanders, but then later on he bought a kit that was like basically the kit that he used on it, because he's like, oh, that was fun. But yeah, John is awesome. He's really fast. He's like running from the control room to the live room and stuff, and like he's like super fun and like energetic. That record was like, yeah, like really fun to make. And it was just I feel like it kind of brought us back to like the like earlier records we had done, in a way of just like moving quickly and just like having fun.
I really debated doing this, asking you to do that record instead, Happiness Hours.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think now, like Awkward Breeds, it's tough because I have like such an emotional connection to it from just when it hit and where I was in life. But I think the more I listen to Happiness, just the better it gets. And like, it's just so cohesive. And to like have like a record in like the age of streaming, like I feel like Happiness Hours, you have to like put it on from the start and see it all the way through. Like if I'm just like driving to a friend's house or something, I only know I'm getting one or two songs. I won't really put it on then. I want to get the whole thing in.
And that's awesome.
But I just thought that always stood out, where it was like, I remember doing like looking back on the year and being like, oh, so many of these, like, you know, my favorite songs are on a bunch of these records. But like when it came to being an actual record, that one like really stood out on, It just seems different now in 2019 or 2018, whenever it came out. I can't remember the year even. Was it last year? It wasn't last
2018,
year. 2018,
yeah.
2018, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, tricky. I find myself listening to like different things depending on like what situation I'm in. Like if I have a chance to change it to something totally different, I find that I usually will, even if I love an album. Versus like if I'm listening on a record, then it's like I like obviously won't just be flipping around. And I kind of like that aspect more. But I feel like lately now it's like I listen to a lot of just like I always like just listening to new singles from whatever, just various things, or just checking different things out. But I don't, yeah, like it's like hard to listen to a whole album, I find, which I think is just like, I guess like the detriment of like all the like playlisting stuff. I like adamantly avoid anytime they like try to give me a playlist. Cause I know that they don't put us on like those kinds of playlists. So I feel like I'm not going to help you. Cause like, and just the way that all their like algorithms work, it's always like, it just like sticks you in this spot, and then it like you're not allowed to be like, you're not going to cross over, even though like with the Sidekicks or something, we like tour with all these other bands. It's like, but we won't appear on a playlist with that. Like our music's just going to be put with like bands from like the fest circa 2005, because that's when we started, which is just so funny that I always think it's funny. Like I hope they get fed like the most like quiet, like, I don't know, like nice song on like our records, like someone's just listening through to something like, what is this shit?
when you look back at Awkward Breeds, where do you rank it in your own discography?
I feel like from a timing perspective, just like what was going on in everyone's lives, and like what was like, I don't know, how was life feeling at that particular moment? I think the making of that record, like the writing and recording of it is probably number one, I think. In terms of like a musical standpoint, I honestly couldn't tell you, but it's in the top three. I feel like Happiness Hours is still kind of like one for me currently. Yeah. But it's the most recent fucking thing, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely have a soft spot for like our latest work, for sure. But Awkward Breeds, I mean, yeah, my first with the band, definitely a special time. And yeah, I was like listening back, and yeah, like certain songs stuck out. I remember like Baby just being like, oh, this is like my favorite song, you know, like off the track right now, you know, like before we even really like started jamming on it. But I was also listening back to all like the sound clips on Awkward Breeds,
mm-hmm.
and like the kids that like started off and in the middle, I was like, oh shit, I kind of remember, because those were kids that I work at a school, and those are actual like kids on the playground. And then I was thinking like how old those kids are now, and I'm like, yeah, they're definitely in high school, almost like getting to college years, you know?
Yeah.
Dude, that's fucking wild.
That's an interesting metric for it, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that, even like thinking about like how, where I was like at work, you know, like, oh, it was just like good times, you know?
Yeah.
And you like look back fondly.
I don't think I I don't like ranking.
Never done the ranking?
I don't like a ranking of music. I'm like, I don't know. I'm like kind of a Scrooge with the, I'm a Scrooge with the, like the whole like albums of the year things, even though we've benefited from, I guess, like the punk news albums of the year. But like, I truly could not like say like, oh, this one's my favorite. This one's my favorite. Cause like, I really, and we did like kind of retrospective, like we played a bunch of songs from our first 7-inch and song Saw You Dog. And then we did Way to Vera songs this past winter. And anytime we go back, I'm always, it's like always just fun. Cause I don't know. I feel like I like having just all these songs that we recorded. Cause I feel like it's just like a document of a time. And I usually look back on it like fondly right after we record a record. And once it's like out, then I'm like, I hate it. And I think it's the worst, like just like, or not hate it, but you're just like, well, I did my best. I wish I could change this, but you kind of get it to a point and then you just have to like let it go and just, yeah.
All right. So what if you're at,
I don't know.
What if you're at Thanksgiving and yeah, you've got like one cool cousin that's like 14 or 15 and they're like, Uncle Steve or Cousin Steve, well, I want to listen to your band. What record should I listen to? And they pull up Spotify. Which one are you going to click on?
I usually will recommend like whatever is the newest thing. Like historically, it's like I think that's what I've always done. And it's not in some weird like sales type of way. I just think it's like that's probably the most, to me, like the most recent thing that I was probably interested in, or like that our band was like interested in. So I don't know. Yeah, like it's tricky because I feel like a lot of people kind of have defined the Sidekicks by Awkward Breeds in a way. Like that was like I, or people have said that like, oh, this is this quintessential, like this is what you guys are in their minds. Like, but I don't know. I feel like, so it's hard to say. I don't know. I feel like I rank them all like very equally. Like sometimes I'll be like, man, I didn't get any better at writing songs, but then like looking back at older songs, I'm just like, yeah, I didn't really have to try that much harder than that. Like sometimes like saying something really simply, it's like can be the best way about it. So I don't know. It's like, depends on the day. I don't usually like put something on to like listen back, but like we've had like different people fill in at various times and I'll have to go back and like relearn it. That was probably the last time I listened to Awkward Breeds. And it was like, that was really fun just to be like, whoa, this like, this room sound is like just overtaking this whole album and it's amazing. I remember the punk news comments of people being like, this record sounded like it was recorded in a bathroom. Or just like,
and you were like, yes, perfect, we did it.
Like, yeah, it's sick.
Yeah,
it's visceral, bro.
Visceral, yeah, exactly.
That was my conversation with Steve, Sanders, and Ryan from The Sidekicks talking about 2012's Awkward Breeds. A lot of good stuff in there. Loved, you know, I love stories like this where a band signs to a label like Epitaph almost purely because they just put out a stellar release. Now, don't get me wrong, Sidekicks were touring on their own, being part of packages. The buzz was there because they did the work. And like they said, obviously the people at Epitaph know what's going on. But they just put out a truly incredible record. So good that Epitaph thought, we need to be part of the next few in their future there. So like I said, Runners in the Nerved World, Happiness Hours, there is a ton in this discography to dig through, to check out. Spotify, Bandcamp, it's everywhere. You can find it easily. The records are still available. And hopefully we see more from them in the future. It's been a long layoff for them. Hopefully there's something coming. If you need to get a hold of the show, you can keep up to date with it on Instagram. That's the best way. That One Record Podcast is the handle. We're on Twitter as well. Same thing, That One Record Podcast. You need to get a hold of me, thatonerecordpodcast@gmail.com. It's the same around the platforms there. And we'll keep chugging on from here, trying to keep it to every 2 weeks. Doesn't always work. where I am in Ontario, we're heading into another partial lockdown again, so maybe some other Ontario bands will be sitting at home with nothing to do, and we'll knock out a few more of these episodes. Until then, thanks for listening. Subscribe on whatever platform you listen to. If you do Apple Music or anything like that, doing ratings and reviews and stuff like that help give some legitimacy to the show. 5 stars, whatever you feel, hit it up there. Thanks for listening. I'm Kyle Crichet, and that was episode 7.